Good morning. You're listening to WPRK, Winter Park, Florida, the best in basement radio. I am Greg Golden.
And I'm Amir Sade.
And you're listening to the Sands Per Hour. The next hour, we will be covering some local goings-ons, including Winter with the Writers. We'll preview the upcoming author, Azar Nafisi, who will be here on Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
We will be playing our talk with Dr. Phil Deaver of Rollins English Department on one of his loves, writing about baseball, and what with spring training hitting off a couple weekends ago, or this past weekend, I think.
You're the sports guy. I know nothing of this.
All right. We'll figure that out by the time we play that interview. And a few tips for spring break, if you're hanging around.
Yeah, you know, things to do, places to go, things to see.
Tips for midterms, if you're having those.
Things to do, things to see, things to watch out for.
We will be having a trivia contest at 9:50, where you may visit our Facebook page, facebook.com/thesandspur, and participate in that for potential winnings of a Gertzberry gift card.
Gertzberry.
That is correct. Over on Morse, off of Park. And what else is going on this morning?
Well, I mean, you know, maybe you should be asking what happened last night.
Oh.
Last night.
That's right. Oscars.
85th Academy Awards.
85, y'all.
Yeah. Oh, well, what I mean, it was amazing. Amazing. I mean, I really enjoyed it.
Me too.
Yeah, Seth MacFarlane, I guess we'll just start from the beginning, really knocked it out of the park as a host. I mean, we kind of mentioned it last week a little bit about, you know, kind of hosts kind of ranging from the really good and controversial to the kind of playing it safe and really boring. And obviously, Seth MacFarlane went to the former, and it just knocked it out of the park. What did you especially like from his opening monologue?
Well, he had great jokes, and no matter who you are, you know, that's going to go over in my book.
Mm-hmm.
And when he went lowbrow, like with the segments that William Shatner introduced of, like, what was going to happen in the show, like, when you're going to go lowbrow, just go all out and don't hide it, and it was really good.
I agree. He went for it, and there was some controversy over especially the Chris Brown and Rihanna.
Right.
But you know, even there, it was just kind of like, oh, yeah, I am Seth MacFarlane. This is why you asked me to host the Oscars. And I think that with that blunt honesty and stuff, like, I think there was just this moment where it's like people could actually, yes, we are part of the industry, and yes, we do crazy things. So, yes, we must be mocked. I enjoyed it. I thought it was really funny.
Mm-hmm.
But, it was a really, really big Academy Awards. A lot of history going on there.
Yeah.
As we had mentioned last week, I can't remember the poor girl's name. 9-year-old in Beast
yes.
of Southern Wilds.
Well, I can't pronounce it either.
But
the last name's Wallace.
But she, Wallace. Miss Wallace, obviously 9 years old, youngest in the Academy.
History, yeah.
To ever be nominated. She didn't win. Jennifer Lawrence won for Silver Linings Playbook, actually making her the second youngest to ever win it. So that was pretty intense. The biggest one, I think, in my mind, well, second biggest one, I'll preface that, Daniel Day-Lewis winning for Best Actor in Lincoln, actually
right.
The third time in any person, any male, has won in that category, making history to be the man with the most, obviously winning it in 2007 for There Will Be Blood, mm-hmm. and then actually in 1989 for My Left Foot. So it was very cool to see that. Very just, you know, again, very historic.
And probably, we already know that it's a record that he won three, but to win in three non-consecutive decades. 80s,
2000s, 2010s. I mean, that's crazy. It's
yeah.
No, it's really awesome to kind of see that, and obviously the big win for me. I mean, Argo knocking that out of the park.
Yeah,
just winning Best Picture. I loved it. Not only Best Picture, but Best Screenplay, original screenplay, or adapted.
Yeah.
Thank you. It was kind of funny. I was watching with a few people, and you know, there's so many ways Ben Affleck could have handled it, because you know, obviously, if you don't know, you know, Ben Affleck was snubbed from Best Director. Throughout all the award season, you know, Golden Globes and Screen Actors Guild and Directors Guild, him and Argo have just won everything, you know, just done an amazing job when it comes to that. And I was kind of like, oh, is he going to say something? Is he going to, you know? And my friend goes and tells me, you know, I think the fact earlier in the night he actually presented an award, I think that just spoke volumes. Because I feel like any other person, like, you're going to ask me to present an award after you obviously snubbed me, as the whole like community understands it. So I think it was very cool of him, very big of him to do. And obviously watching his acceptance speech at the end of the night, just tearing up, like, you could just see the emotion on his face. And just what an amazing story, what an amazing win. So that was one of my big highlights of the night, was just to see that. And also Shirley Bassey singing Goldfinger.
That was good.
Wow. In her 80s now and still rocking out with those pipes. I mean, wow.
That was good. I think that there was overall a great bringing back of music into the show.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's something that they've taken from these other award shows, like the Grammys. Obviously, the Grammys is about music, but it's able to bring to life what their performers do. You know?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And
exactly.
So, you know, obviously the Grammys can make music because that's able to come through, you know, their medium on TV.
Mm-hmm.
The Emmys, in some ways, is making TV from one standpoint.
Yeah.
But it's not the sort of TV that is winning awards. You know, it's not scripted stuff.
Yeah.
And then the Oscars has really lived by montages in the past that have really... A lot of them have fallen flat, hit or miss, make the show too long sort of thing. But they had plenty of music.
Plenty, oh yes.
Not just from the nominated song category.
They did a whole, they did a retrospective. Actually, it was the 10-year anniversary that Chicago won an Academy Award. And they had Catherine Zeta sing all that jazz. And then they had Jennifer Hudson sing her big song from Dreamgirls. And then they obviously ended off with the big number in Les Mis. And it was just really cool, to see that, to see like really amazing musicals be appreciated and just show that, you know, over the last 10 years, it has really been an amazing year for musicals, whether it be Hairspray, whether it be, you know, Dreamgirls,
whatever it be, decade. So that was special. And Seth MacFarlane is, Broadway lover, so
yes.
that was fitting. He actually got to sing a bit and did very well with that. And then bringing in the actors to dance and perform with him was another interesting aspect.
Yes.
Because that's another one of these ways in which they're able to use what the draw is. The draw is stars. The draw is watching the actors get around with each other and with giving awards, and then also now being able to perform in these other ways.
Well, of course, it was great. It was obviously Daniel Radcliffe and Jordan Gordon-Levitt had that, and I can watch Charlize Theron dance for hours. So
right, as
that
she
was
did with,
as she did with Channing Tatum.
Channing Tatum. Yeah,
I was obviously more transfixed on Ms. Theron, but that is another time for another day, another story. Anyways, but yes, Oscars, amazing. I liked it. A really solid ceremony from start to finish. Can't complain. Cannot complain.
Yeah, and there was some cheekiness that I thought was really good for them to bring in. Like, they would play off people with the Jaws theme. That was very good.
Yeah.
You know, and that's just another way of you know, just do it. If you're going to send someone off, just make it completely obvious.
Just do it.
Just
like,
do it.
We all know, and I think that that's just like we all know the little tidbits now. It's like, when again, like, I feel like when these people, when stars and the industry can make fun of itself and realize, yes, we're Hollywood,
yeah,
we're crazy, like, that's when we can all just, it makes it that 10 times more appreciative and just like, yes, like, this is fun for everybody.
Well said. I guess capping off, I was surprised by Django's wins.
Yeah. I felt that I definitely thought Christoph Waltz. Excuse me. I definitely felt he was going to win. I definitely wanted him to. But I agree, you know, Tarantino makes an amazing film. And to win, it's the second time he's won. Originally for Pulp Fiction. You know, I really agree with the sentiment of his speech, was that, you know, I only get one chance to put my characters out there and being able to have a wonderful set of actors to portray those in this once of a lifetime opportunity, and for it to work so well, you know, he just really hit the nail on the head. It's like, you know, yes, you can write a movie and a script, but if you don't have the right people to portray that image and put that out there, then it isn't going to work out. And luckily, he just found an all-star stellar cast. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Kudos to Tarantino.
And another tidbit you learned from his speech is Neighbors with Charlize Theron.
Neighbors with, right? Like, now I know who to visit if I want to be Charlize Theron and also have a nice chit chat with Quentin Tarantino. So, I mean, come on, that's pretty cool. That, I mean, again, right, showing their humanity, showing their, like, yeah, you know, cool stuff.
In a way.
in a way, of course.
Because there's probably already an assumption out there that everyone's living in the same neighborhood or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah.
But, you know, that was the Oscars. It still did run long as usual, but it didn't feel like it, though.
No.
That's the thing.
No, it was
full.
It just felt right. Yes, I felt full. I didn't feel like I was having to, like, chug through the Oscars. Like, no, by the end I was like, oh, awesome. I can't wait to see what the next thing Seth is going to say and, like, who's going to win, because, again, like, again, it's not just the show. It's also the nominees, and when you have movies of such an amazing caliber all competing and vying, and you can make, you know, really good arguments for, like, how this movie should win or this movie, that's when you get energized. Like, you're just like, because then you actually want to know, like, who's going to win, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that was really cool.
Another important breakthrough, having presenters present two awards consecutively.
Right? You know, as a way to cut down on time, you know, why not have them do not only the original, but also the adapted, or having sound mixing and sound editing.
Hey-o. Yeah, so ultimately, things are looking good. After a few shaky years where they were trying to find their footing.
I think they just realized, like, you know what, like, we can make, you know, obviously it'll always depend on the feeling of the year, but I definitely think that, like, they're like, you know what, we can be a little risque, and people will appreciate it, and people will watch it, and people will enjoy it, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good stuff. I guess Les Mis wasn't exactly a loser, but they didn't come away with much.
Well, they did come away with, I mean, of course,
Anne Hathaway's
win,
yeah.
And, I will say that it is kind of funny that when it comes to what best original song, the whole thing is a musical, and I mean, like, there is no spoken dialogue, so it's all songs, and who ends up winning? Adele. So,
well, was that even up for that?
Yeah. Well, they had their own suddenly. So
okay.
It makes sense. So, I mean, obviously, you know, it maybe isn't necessarily in the same category because, you know, Adele is, like, you know, writing this song as this, and technically Les Mis is well known for its pieces. It's you know, already written, well known 20, 30, 40 years of music. But I just kind of found that funny. It's like, oh, Adele beat out the movie that was pretty much one long soundtrack. So, but yeah, I know. It was really cool. I really liked that.
Mm-hmm. Good stuff.
Good stuff.
So we will transition, and now you will hear a song that I've picked out, which is Oscar, at least movie relevant. I think this movie won an Oscar. And we will see you after this.
Woo!
That was Everybody's Talking from Harry Nilsson, which was in Midnight Cowboy, an Oscar winner, except on IMDb, there's this, like, Game of Thrones ad that's flying over the screen that isn't going away. So it's not letting me, it's not letting me click what Oscars it won. But
it won Oscars, folks.
It won three.
It won three.
So it's relevant. Anywho.
Anywhoozle.
Moving right along. Really cool stuff this Thursday to culminate the Winner with the Writers season that has been going on for the past 3 weeks on Rollins campus. Yeah.
And even to interesting add a very built-in segue of after Argo won Best Picture.
There we go.
We have a wonderful Dr. Azar Nafisi coming this Thursday. Not coming Thursday for Winner with the Writers and actually coming the day before on Wednesday for the Winter Park Institute. So actually coming for both organizations, which is really interesting. If you don't know, Dr. Azar Nafisi is very well known for her memoirs, her biggest one being Reading Lolita and Heron, which is a memoir of hers talking about her experiences right after the Iranian Revolution, kind of being a professor and teaching in Iran, retiring, and also teaching from 95 to 97, a secret book club with a few of the girls in her class, and talking about all types of literature from, obviously, Lolita, The Great Gatsby, work from Jane Austen, Pride and Prejudice and whatnot, and kind of looking at the many themes that are brought up, from oppression to heroes versus villains, what makes a hero, what makes a villain, and kind of just talking about the whole gambit. That'll be very interesting to have her as an Iranian American. These last few months have been very interesting to kind of obviously see Iran in the limelight through media, obviously with Argo, and kind of seeing on the big screen, and then now obviously having Dr. Nafisi come. It's really inspiring, and really, at least for me, it gets me jazzed to always kind of have somebody of Iranian descent, Middle Eastern descent, kind of come and show all the amazing work she's done, and just having such an amazing role model in the community. I'm excited. I'm excited to see her. And as Greg mentioned, she is the last Winner with the Writers writer, because it's the end of February. Mm-hmm. Shocking, right? So, yeah.
Yeah, and a little backstory on her book, Reading Lolita in Tehran. It spent 117 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. It was named one of the 100 best books of the decade by the Times of London.
Wow.
And it really is spectacularly written. It's, I don't want to say poetic because it's a cliche, but it is poetic. It is just so fluidly written, concise.
I mean,
would
I mean, I loved it. I think, I mean, it's broken up into four chapters, each named after,
one
of the books that she had discussed. And, it's really, if you want to understand kind of post-revolutionary Iran and just kind of how it was for people, women, intellectuals, and just people, a good majority, and there are a lot of Iranians post right after the revolution who she just kind of best describes it as just having their dreams shattered, kind of hoping that with this revolution they would have new sets of freedoms and would be able to live their life easier and kind of get that American dream, but only in Iran, you know? And unfortunately, that wasn't the case. Ended up being, you know, Iran, obviously, now, as you see, is the Islamic Republic. Very repressive, theocratical, and some would just say dictatorial. I think she best kind of talks about it when she talks about, just for instance, like not wanting to wear a veil. That whole concept of the veil being oppressive and kind of being a physical manifestation of, one class, one gender being less than in this new patriarchal society. So I just think it's an amazing book to read. I mean, there's so many perspectives you can come from it. I mean, obviously women's studies, history, political science, there are so many things in the book for so many people, and to have her come and to talk about it, not only to talk about obviously her views and her ideas and her history, but also then later to talk about the book itself and the writing process, that I think is definitely something that'll be very interesting to see.
Right. You talk about literature in an English class as how it relates to maybe the form in which it was written, perhaps what the book communicates to the age in which it was written, and perhaps the age that it exists in now, and to see it applied to, as you said, post-revolutionary Iran is just a fascinating another look at how does Lolita and Nabokov's work interact with this society versus obviously the one that was different than Iran in some ways, but also, as Nafisi talks about, was one that was marred by war, in which Nabokov had to write in a certain amount of privacy and shield himself from what was going on in the outside world.
And juxtaposing it to the Iran-Iraq War of the 80s. I mean, it gives a very distinct snapshot of Iran kind of trying to find itself after the 79 revolution and seeing it just get torn to pieces and just kind of, the people wanting one thing and then the government being another thing and then obviously having war right after it. So it's not even a sense of, oh, well, like, maybe we can reform or we can change this. And then it immediately becomes like we are fighting a war against Iraq that lasts almost a decade, lasts 8 years. Like, we don't have time. Like, a sense, it's fighting that sense of nationalism and fighting, like, our, brothers are dying to one poignant quote that she mentions, like, saying, the school children saying, oh, they're dead. Thank God they're dead. They're with their beloved God now, kind of with, cause the regime obviously being very big on God, very Islamic, but also oppressive. And it's like, oh, well, good riddance. So it's like, it touches on so many different issues and how, looking at the Middle East and looking at Iran, and it's not cut and dry at all. There are so many levels, so many layers, and so much history in this region that you have to just truly, when you start to unravel it, it just becomes so amazing to just be like, wow, there is so much more here than meets the eye, and so much more than you can ever get in a 5-minute soundbite on CNN or a quick little article on the Drudge Report or HuffPo.
Right, because when you talk about it being a snapshot, it is a deep focus, high resolution snapshot down to the type of language that the people in Iran use. In one instance, she talks about how whenever someone wants to make a claim about Iran going in the wrong direction, they say, "Who are we, Switzerland?" And that was surprising to me. I mean, not to be self-centered as an American, but you would think that it's America that they're comparing themselves to. But instead you have this country that America makes claims about in terms of its own political and military stances. You know, how we think of Switzerland as being a neutral country and this and that is far different than how Iran compares itself to it. And so even just getting that wake-up call comparison that, I didn't think anyone thought Switzerland was that bad.
No, right? I mean, it's, it is a good book. I've read it, and I really enjoyed it. And I think it is great. Actually, it's so crazy to hear how President Duncan really loves Azar Nafisi and actually was one of the big proponents of getting her to come to Rollins. And it's very interesting to, you know, to kind of see that process and have her come. And I think she's going to bring a lot to offer. And, it's just very relevant to the season and to the climate of what's been going on with, just obviously media, but I mean the ever saga that is Iran that you see in the news and whatnot. So.
And so her reading for Winter with the Writers is on Thursday at 7:30 in the Tiedtke Auditorium. And what's this event on Wednesday? I haven't heard of.
Yes, it's going to be in Tiedtke as well. It's the WPI
Winter Park Institute?
Yes.
Oh, you're looking
it up. I'm looking it up.
That was your typing, talking to yourself.
That's what I like to do, what I
voice.
Do. Yes, she will be coming February 27th at 8 p.m., where she will be talking about the Republic. Well, the name of her talk is Republic of the Imagination. Dr. Azar Nafisi discusses the relationship between politics, culture, and human rights in that country. She will emphasize the rights of women and girls and the role they play in the process of change for pluralism and an open society. Actually, it's 7:30, and a book signing will follow the Tiedtke Concert Hall Keene Music Building.
Great. And also on Thursday, there's a book signing afterwards, and between her reading and that signing, there is a Q&A session led by Carol Frost, the director of Winter with the Writers, which is always entertaining and will be, I think, one of the best, fill in the blanks, one of the best
times
of her being here.
Yes,
will come in that Q&A that will be participatory from the audience.
Yes. So that is the information. If you would like to go.
Yes.
So now let's have a little bit of fun with our boys, the Beach Boys.
Of the Beach.
Yes.
And that was the Beach Boys with fun.
I mean, so much fun, you know. I enjoy fun. They enjoy fun. That's why we're buds.
So before this campus goes off and has their fun, we got some midterms.
Midterms.
I mean, you, not me.
I have midterms. I have many a midterm.
And so when you have these said midterms, there's some good ways to de-stress.
Exactly. Besides getting into the fetal position and crying, there are actually, before you get into the fetal position, there are a few things that you can do to relax. As surprising as it may be, exercising actually helps. It actually does good. Whether it's jogging, running, or even just doing yoga for like 10, 15 minutes, getting yourself out of your room, getting yourself in nature or just out of the situation, kind of get the blood flowing and, you know, getting your mind
fresh air,
all of that stuff is good for you. It will help in the de-stress process. And a lot of times when you have separated yourself from the assignment, that's when you have those big eureka moments. So definitely take some time out and exercise. Or just do something. Get out in nature. Also, I've also highly stressed.
De-stress.
No, I de-stress. Thanks, Greg. A little bit of procrastination time. Now, I say this with an obvious caveat. You don't want to spend 4 hours watching Law & Order like I do as a de-stressor because, I'm sorry, Law & Order is like Pringles. Once you watch one show, you can't really stop at just one. But a little bit of time, 30 minutes, 45 minutes, at tops an hour, and that's only, I mean, if you really have an hour, great. But, you know, around that 25 to 45 minute mark, yes, take some time for yourself. Probably not, maybe not watch TV, but, you know, listen to music, even take a quick nap, a short nap, or, you know, just kind of relax. And that, something like that, again, is getting your mind out of it, kind of giving yourself just some time to breathe, kind of just taking away the stress. That's a big thing, because as much as we all try and cram and spend like 5-6 hours in the library, it doesn't do anybody any good after about hour three. You know, you're freaking out. Like, so you just gotta definitely schedule in some, schedule in some procrastination time.
Yeah, and the scheduling helps. It really doesn't do you any good to say, I'm gonna sit down and study for 6 hours.
No.
Doesn't work.
Because it doesn't. No, it doesn't. You say you're going to study for 6 hours, and you study for one. You take a quick break. That quick break ends up being an hour and a half because you were just like, I studied so long. And then you freak out, and you're like, okay, I'm going to have to like study again like for another 2 hours. And then by like after that, you're just like, I'm done. So you've gotten about a total of like 3 hours out of those six.
At most.
So, I mean, if you got a lot to do, yes. Definitely do it, but plan it over a few days. Give yourself some makeup time, you know, because things happen. So definitely scheduling is another big one. Number three, if you want to de-stress, schedule things out. Figure out when you want to do things. I don't know. Those are the big three. I definitely also, for eye on the prize, I think that's the biggest thing, too. You know, it is very easy to be like, it's almost spring break, I'm going to check out. But unfortunately, the way our educational system is run, before you can totally relax, they decide to put one of the most difficult and, of course, most weighty of assignments right before you just want to check out. So always remember, yes, it's not Miller time yet, folks, but it's so, so close, and you're going to enjoy it 10 times more, if you don't flunk your midterms.
Yeah, and going off the theme of scheduling, maybe you say to yourself, okay, while I'm doing breakfast, I'm just going to read through some of these notes, you know, and then maybe that hooks you and you do a little extra from the 10 minutes maybe you were going to plan on spending with that material.
Right.
And so there's little ways of doing it that way. And then, let's see, you brought something to mind.
Ooh.
That I've now forgotten.
Nice.
Well, music.
Music.
That's another one. You sort of have the difference between music that you can listen to when you're studying, and then you have that de-stress, chill out, take a break music.
Mm-hmm.
Which is which for you?
Me, I you know, I've never really been big on listening to music while I study. So I use music as a relaxing type of like that's my relaxing. But definitely, I know a lot of people who do classical while they study, and then something with lyrics, like with actual lyrics to relax or whatnot. So,
yeah.
How about you? Is that you, or how do you work?
Yeah, Mozart I could study to, read to, whatever, but. If it has lyrics, it has to be something that I know really well, or else I'll get caught up in it.
Right, because then you don't want to actually listen to what the song is about. And then
exactly. That's where they get you.
Oh, right. They get you at the words, folks. They get you at the words.
Yes. So maybe if it's like putting on a Pandora station of stuff that I know I've already heard a ton of times before, like maybe the Buddy Holly station. What's up?
The Backstreet Boys station.
Boys?
The boys. They're new. They're from the. They're
from Boynton Beach.
Yes, they're Boynton. They're Jersey. They're from the Jersey Boys. Jersey Boys.
Oh, okay.
So yes, but I mean, again, all in all, as a wrap up, as I kind of bring it all together, you know, exercise, make time for yourself, schedule when you can. Music is also always helpful, and keep your eyes guys, us and the prize guys, you know, we're so close. 4 days to spring break. Four or five, you know, depending on how you're looking at it. Once you get there, it's going to be tasty. It's going to be wonderful. Just don't worry. We're all pulling for you, especially at the Sands per Hour. Me and Greg specifically are pulling just for you. Yes, yeah. You.
You, listener.
Not you on the right. Not your friend. You. You specifically.
And now we will go into our interview with Dr. Philip Deaver, who is a professor of English, Rollins writer in residence, author of books of short stories and poems, and editor of the creative nonfiction collection, Scoring from Second, Writers on Baseball. Our conversation begins with, for lack of a better way of putting it, me stuttering through my first question. Here you go. Spring training began for the major league this past weekend. What's your plans for spring training?
Well, I always go to Jupiter a couple of times during spring training, during the month. Spring break falls in that time, so I go down. And sometimes I stay about halfway between the Mets' spring training site and the Cardinals and go back and forth to the one that interests me the most. And usually that's if the Cardinals go play the Mets. What do I like about spring training and what do I get from it? I like to scope out the Cardinals in person. When I first moved to Florida, the Cardinals were in spring training in Tampa, where the Yankees are now, and I took my sons to see them in Kissimmee playing the Astros. And that was the first spring training I'd ever really actually gone to. And this is going to date me big time, but the manager of the Cardinals at the time was Whitey Herzog. And my sons had listened to baseball with me on the radio when we lived back in the Midwest. And they got to sit there right behind the screen, behind home plate, while Whitey Herzog was leaning on the screen, shooting the bull with the home plate umpire. And it was so inside baseball, and it was so intimate with the big game, the show. It was so intimate with that my kids were just thrilled. They got Tommy Herr's autograph that day, who played second base for the Cardinals in those times. And it just was a wonder to them. It just opened their eyes up. And I watched them thrill to baseball like I thrilled to baseball on that very day. And then it was just done. We were going to go see the Cardinals. And if we couldn't see the Cardinals, we were definitely going to go see baseball every spring.
And so 2 points for our listeners if they're unfamiliar with you. One, you're from St. Louis.
I'm from the central Illinois in an area that was a border zone between Cubs territory and Cardinals territory. And for me, that's no choice.
And then the other half of this equation is that you're a writer and a writer of baseball.
Yes, I like to write about baseball, but I'm getting a little bit too much credit for writing about baseball. In fact, I'm just a literary short story writer and I write poems. And notice I didn't say I was a poet. I love the game, and one day, many years ago, I was trying to think of a story to write, and I asked myself the question, what haven't I written about, or what is so close to me that I don't even notice, it, like writing about my right hand? What's that close to me? And it came up baseball. So I wrote a short story called Infield, and it starts with reminiscences of Little League and Pony League in my hometown, and it goes on into a huge autobiographical dump, really, and not really about baseball at all. So my thing about writing about sports attempts to capture people's imagination about the things that they might want to write about that is closer to them than they even would even think about writing. And a literary writer, you know, despite its reputation for being a kind of literary game or a game that is fascinating to literary people, baseball is, you know, a big, tough sport, really, and kind of an entertainment and sort of a clown show sometimes. So I don't admire the game so much poetically as I do just sort of grittily, and also recalling it in my own past, it puts me in a really good place, like it did when I went to that story. When I started writing about that, it just dropped me into a huge comfort zone. I was bottomless in what I could write about in that story. So it's really personal experience, and, you know, the male initiation sort of thing. All of that is very interesting to me, and that's really how I hook into baseball. So, you know, anybody that's moved by baseball like I am, if they're a writer, they're going to write about it. But often you'll find that it isn't baseball that I'm writing about. It's something else, and in a way, baseball's the medium.
And so it's more of baseball as a frame for human experience.
Yes, right.
What then does baseball unlock for you in a particular story?
I'll just put it like this. My father was a doctor, and he was rather distant. He wasn't distant because he was a distant person. He was a very warm person, but in fact, he was extremely busy. A small town doctor. People had no other options. He was like the man, and he was 24/7 all the time. And he was gone a lot. He was at the hospital a lot. And every time the sirens went off in my hometown, my dad might as well just get in the car and go to the hospital without even waiting for the phone. So that's kind of the way it was with him. So I went to my first baseball game, and I admired Stan Musial. This is 1957. I admired Stan Musial, who was going to win the batting title National League that year. MVP, I think. And I got to watch my dad respond to Stan Musial. My dad wasn't so into baseball, but I got him into a baseball stadium and got him watching this great guy and watched him react to Musial. And that told me something about my father. And I always remember it. I always remember, you know, after that, my dad would report to me how Musial did in games. And all during the summer, you know, he'd come tell me about it if I hadn't already read about it. And so that's just kind of the effect. Musial was born about the same year, maybe 1 year later than my father. So in a way, I had this kind of point of reference that was outside of us and off that way. And I got a chance to sort of put my dad in some kind of context. Very hard to explain, but when you're not around your father so much, you begin to look for points of reference in order to sort of define him. And that was one of the ways I did it.
The Cardinals offseason, unfortunately, was defined by the loss of Stan Musial, a legendary outfielder, an all-time player, besides being the connection of worlds that he was between you and your father. Is that the memory that you have the most of him upon his loss?
The memory that I have the most of him, that I talk about a lot, is in 1962 when he was trying to get his 3,000th hit. And my dad and I were all fired up about going down to St. Louis and seeing if we could be there on a Sunday. I think it was a doubleheader in those days, two games for the price of one, and you just spend all day at the ballpark. I mean, throw me in that briar patch. And we got down there, and Musial didn't get his 3,000th hit. But what I'll always remember is Wally Moon, and now it wasn't Wally Moon, but it was great players: Ken Boyer, Alex Gramas, people like that, who were standing on the steps of the dugout with their own movie cameras, photographing Musial as he maybe was going to get his 3,000th hit. I mean, when do you ever see that? When do you ever see that now? The admiration of stars for a consummate star.
Mm-hmm.
That's the key Musial thing that I remember. And he, mm-hmm. by the way, got the hit against the Cubs the following week. It was a double.
One of the fascinating things about Musial, he's not remembered as well as Joe DiMaggio or other stars who seem to surpass what the game meant and were known as celebrities as well. DiMaggio in particular with his marriage to Marilyn Monroe. And Musial, on the other hand, was simply a great baseball player.
Right.
And simply a even-keeled baseball player.
Here's how even-keeled he was. I got an email from a friend of mine who told me that her mother graduated from high school with Stan Musial, and he always came back to the class reunions. That's pretty low-key.
Right.
For a star.
So perhaps he was the Midwestern star that really embodied the spirit of what people consider to be Midwestern values and really appropriated that into the legendary player that he was. And a statistic that we looked up prior to this interview was his retirement as, while having the same amount of hits, 1,815 on the road, equaling his 1,815 hits at home.
Right.
What does that mean?
Well, traditionally, teams do better at home than they do on the road. But in a 22-year career, this it made absolutely no difference to him what stadium he was playing in. His productivity was huge no matter where. And it's just a very pleasing statistic. And it's one of the most unusual statistics. You just won't run into something like that. I mean, in a 22-year career, it's just astonishing.
On March 30th, you have a writing workshop that is centered around baseball, occurring at Urban Rethink. And what will you urge your writers to find when they consider baseball as a subject?
I think when we put baseball out on the promotion for the workshop, that I'll get some people who really know what I'm talking about when I talk about how baseball can actually cause you to click in a creative way, especially if they're from the generation that played Little League and Pony League and all of those and all the way through school. And just remember all that from the perspective of being much older and just looking back at that time. So I think that that's a lot of the people that will come in. But as I was quick to stipulate in the promotion for the workshop is really not going to be about baseball. It's really going to be about creativity. And I intend to show them how baseball was a gateway for some creativity from me and try to find the key for them.
Thank you for joining us today.
Yes, great. Thanks for coming over.
Those early years were lots of fun, and though they lost more than they won, baseball had returned to Baltimore. Put two Robbies in the mix, and by 1966, the Orioles had put the Dodgers down in four. I'm talking baseball. Gentile and John Orsino, Oriole baseball. Hoyt and Aparicio, the Kitty Corps, Triandos, Billy Lowe's.
And thanks to Dr. Phil Deaver for joining us. His workshop, again, is on March 30th. It will be from 10:30 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. at Urban Rethink in Thornton Park. More information about how to attend is available at urbanrethink.com. And now we have a few minutes left to talk, one, about our contest of the week. Last week, our question about what Jack Kerouac manuscript is housed in Rollins' archives on one single roll of teletype paper went incorrectly answered. Our lone answer was On the Road, which is incorrect.
I know.
It was The Dharma Bums.
Whoa!
His follow-up to On the Road, which he wrote in that house on Cloyser Street in College Park, not too far from here, where the Kerouac Project exists to house international writers, to allow them to live where Kerouac lived, and produce some sort of writing in the time that they are in residence there.
Very cool.
If you want to read more about that, it's available at kerouacproject.org. But ultimately, you guys were wrong.
Ouch, Greg. Being, ouch.
You guys being one person who guessed.
Don't pull any punches.
But this week, hey, you got stuff to do. I'm going to throw up a softball here.
Softball.
And posting it up to our Facebook page right now, facebook.com/thesandspur. In what year was the Sandspur founded?
Yeah. I don't think it's much of a softball. Maybe a baseball.
Hey-o.
Hey-o. Jokes.
Metaphor be darned.
Nah.
So look out for that. If you are our first responder, correct responder, you will win a Gertzberry gift card
Gertzberry
that we will get to you. As we close, we want to talk about what are some things you could do if you
spring break locales.
Yeah, if you're
local
not
spring break locales. There's a lot. One of my all-time favorites, Enzion Theater.
Yes.
Off the beaten path a little. Not really too off the beaten, but definitely can go there for nostalgic movies, foreign films, films that you can't see in the theaters. Obviously, there's the theme parks, you know, Universal, Disney, SeaWorld, Busch Gardens, Wet n' Wild. Definitely, if it starts to get warm and hot, you can get cool. There's always Putt-Putt Golf. Who doesn't like golf? The Pirate Cove? I can't remember the name.
Yeah, Pirate's Cove.
Pirate's Cove. Always fun. Speaking of fun, Fun Spot. All that fun, you know, Fun Spot. You got the go-karts and the games and the fun. And then always, hey, if you can't get out, you can't pay, you're like, no, I'm not leaving. I need something in the good, like, mile radius. Always the wonderful, the beautiful, the lovely Lake Virginia. I mean, you can jet ski, you can boat, you can fish.
I thought you said low cost.
I mean, if you have a jet ski, a boat, or a fishing pole, then that is low cost.
Okay,
if not,
prohibitive.
If not, you can always get a pair of swim trunks.
Barriers to entry, Amir. Barriers to entry.
Well, if not, you can always just lay on the dock, look at the beautiful lake.
You may borrow a bike from Olin Library and bike around. That is free.
You can bike or you can lay. Laying is free. Is it
sure
free,
it
Greg?
Is. Sure it is.
I don't know why I work with you. Okay, folks, again, thank you so much. Amir Sadeh, Greg Colden, the Sandspur Hour. I hope you have a lovely week. Good luck on those midterms and have a wonderful, wonderful spring break, folks.
Till next time.